because history is important. In fact, I would argue that U.S. history is absolutely crucial for your job as an American. But the textbooks deliberately leave out the present and don't bring in it, because that would be controversial. And that's the last thing they want to be.
That's James Lowen, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features James Lowen on history textbooks, facts or fiction. There's a famous quote in George Orwell's 1984. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Orwell understood how important knowledge of history is and how it can be manipulated by the powerful to serve their interests. If the past disappears down the memory hole, as it does in 1984, society is at risk. History is not some neutral, ideologically free zone. It is a highly contested battlefield. The contents of textbooks are subject to partisan bias, often tilting to the right. Inadequate history textbooks help produce adults who can't distinguish evidence from opinion, fact from fiction. Progressive voices such as Frederick Douglass, Emma Goldman, and Dorothy Day, just to mention a few, are often omitted from textbooks, or just appear without context. James Lowen said, "Telling the truth about the past helps cause justice in the present. Achieving justice in the present helps us tell the truth about the past." Our guest today is James Lowen. James Lowen is the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, winner of the American Book Award. He also wrote Lies Across America and Sundown Towns. Lowen was a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont. He died in August 2021. We present this talk, recorded in 2018, in his memory. He spoke at a benefit banquet for KFCF at the historic Holy Trinity Armenian Apostolic Church in Fresno, California. And now, James Lowen.
My first full-time teaching job was at Tougaloo College in Mississippi. Tougaloo was a liberating force in a lot of people's lives in Mississippi. It is one of maybe two or three colleges, and only two or three, that actually liked the civil rights movement and supported it. Most other colleges, including most other black colleges, were afraid of it. There I was teaching at Tougaloo College, teaching the sociology courses I expected to be teaching, but I was also asked to teach and did teach one section of a course called the Freshman Social Science Seminar. Now, this was a course that introduced students to, you know the drill, anthro, soc, poli-sci, psych, econ. And it did this in the context of African-American history, and in fact had been invented by the history department. 99%+ of our students being African-American, that made sense. Well, when you're in that context, that's, of course, the same chronology as, shall we say, regular American history. The second semester begins right after the Civil War with the period known as... Much louder, much better. Okay. Of course, some of you lived through it. But. So I had a new group of students. I had 17 students that January afternoon. I didn't want to do all the talking, so I asked them, okay, what was Reconstruction? What images come to your mind? What happened back then? And what happened to me was an aha experience, or perhaps better described as an oh no experience. 16 of my 17 students summarized Reconstruction like this. Reconstruction was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states. But now there's a reaction I really appreciate. No, I'm dead serious. Not just hers, but there are other people moaning, all right? When blacks took over the government of the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. And thank you for that reaction. Yeah, there's at least three, maybe four direct lies in that sentence, right? Black folks, of course, never took over the government of the southern states. All of the states had white governors throughout the period. All but one had white legislative majority. Second of all, the Reconstruction governments did not screw up. Without exception, across the South, they passed much better state constitutions than the Southern states have ever had, including better than the ones that they labor under now. Third, therefore, white folks didn't take over at the end of Reconstruction. A certain batch of white folks took over at the end of Reconstruction. White racist Democrats using KKK tag. Of course, it was indeed the original Ku Klux Klan. And so I thought to myself, my God, what must it do to you to believe that the one time your group was center stage in American history, they screwed up? Now, if this is true, if this happened, then you have to face it. You have to say, what happened? Let's figure this out. But it did not happen. This is an example of what we in sociology call BS. All right? That's bad sociology. So how could this happen? So I went to nearby high schools, and I watched. And this was just before massive school desegregation in the Deep South. So I went to nearby black high schools, and I watched as black teachers taught all black classes white supremacist BS because they were just teaching what was in the book. So what to do about it? Well, for about a year and a half, I tried to get historians to write a new textbook, particularly for the course Mississippi History, which was required in fifth grade and required again in ninth grade. And this double requirement, incidentally, was part of the bills that the state of Mississippi passed in the 1955 and 56 legislative session as a response to Brown versus Board of Education to maintain, quote, our Southern way of life, unquote. All right. So I failed. The history teachers were all busy doing their arcane research. So finally, I got a grant, and I collected a batch of students and faculty at Tougaloo and also at Millsaps, the nearby white college, and we wrote a new history of Mississippi. It won the Lillian Smith Award for Best Southern Nonfiction of the Year, and it was rejected by the state of Mississippi for school use. And if you get rejected in a state that supplies free textbooks even to private and parochial schools, which Mississippi does, you are truly rejected. Ain't nobody going to use you, all right? So we eventually sued them. And the lawsuit, in fact, is called Lowen et al. Versus Turnipseed et al. Yes, there are people in Mississippi named Turnipseed. And in fact, that's why I made him the lead defendant. And Mississippi is a tall state, not as tall as California, and so it has a northern and a southern judicial district. The state government, Jackson, is located in the southern district, but the southern district was overrun with really racist judges appointed by Nixon and Kennedy, whereas the northern district had some halfway decent judges appointed by Lyndon Johnson and Dwight Eisenhower. You might think about that. And so we couldn't make the textbook board as an entity the lead defendant, or we would be under these unfortunate, terrible judges. Turnipseed lived in the Northern District, and that was the other reason we picked him, although several other people lived in the Northern District too. Let me go on just for a minute and say, when I made Turnipseed the lead defendant, unbeknownst to me, I was taking away my 15 seconds of fame. Because if you think about it, Plessy V. Ferguson is really known by the shorthand of Plessy, of course. Brown v. Board is known as? Brown. And Lowen v. Turnipseed is known as?
Turnipseed.
It's terrible. It is pretty well known. It's actually one of the 9 lawsuits that the American Library Association cites at its website that give us all freedom to read, because, as you can infer, we won the case. And indeed, we won the case at a very dramatic moment. Mr. Turnipseed was on the stand when we had this. You guys, some of you are old enough to know what I'm talking about if I use the term Perry Mason moment. Okay? I don't say that anymore to students. They say, write down Perry Mason. Okay. So, what happened? The Assistant Attorney General for the state of Mississippi asks Turnipseed, why did you vote against this book? Okay? There were 7 people on the board, 2 blacks, 5 whites. And by 2-5, we were rejected for, you know, they typically adopt 3 to 5 books in any subject. In Mississippi history, they didn't have but 2, ours and theirs. But by 2 to 5, they rejected ours and just only adopted theirs. And that's why we sued. So Turnipseed is on the stand, and the assistant attorney general says, "Why did you reject this book?" And he had us turn to the page in our book where there is a photograph of a lynching. Now, as lynching photographs go, it is a tasteful photograph. There's no body parts being cut off. It's kind of at a distance. A black man is being burned alive, and there's a fire behind. And then there's these well-dressed white ladies and gentlemen happy to be photographed while they are committing the felony of murder. Okay, and of course that's why we use the photo. That's what's so important about a lynching, that it is a public murder done with considerable support of the community, and that's why these folks are willing to be photographed, because they know ain't nothing going to be done to them. All right, and that's a chilling message you're sending to everybody. And so Turnipseed said, and I quote him exactly, he said, "Now you know some ninth graders, especially black male ninth graders, are pretty big. And we worried, or at least I worried, that teachers, especially white lady teachers, might have trouble controlling their classes with material like this in the book." Well, so our book was going to cause racial unrest. We had pre-tested our book. We had piloted it with an overwhelmingly white class and with an overwhelmingly black class, and they both liked it all to pieces better than their book. So we had material for rebuttal testimony on this point. But we didn't have to use it, because at that time, right then, the judge, 83-year-old white Mississippian, Orma Smith, a man of honor, took over the questioning. And he said, and I quote, "But that happened, didn't it? Didn't Mississippi have more lynchings than any other state?" Which it did. And Turnipseed said, and I quote, "Well, yes, but that all happened so long ago. Why dwell on it now?" And the judge said, "Well, it is a history book." And we elbowed each other and said, "We're going to win this case." And we did win the case. Our book was ordered adopted for the 6-year period. But that whole escapade taught me that history can be a weapon, that it can be used against you, and that it had been used against my students. And I submit to you, it had also been used against the white students in the state. Because what chance did they have to grow up halfway decent on race? You know, they're in segregated schools they don't even go to school with or have anything to do with, play in an athletic contest or anything. They're black peers. And then they are taught that the one time those people ran the whole state, which of course they didn't, they screwed up, you know. So it's a terrible thing. Well, after 7 years, I left Tougaloo. I went to the University of Vermont. I claim I have taught at the blackest and the whitest schools in America. Right? Now, the UVM, as it's called, actually does have black students. And in fact, one semester, I had her in class. So my first year students, whom I continued to teach in huge classes of intro social, they convinced me that they knew all kinds of idiotic things that never happened in our past, and they didn't know all kinds of things that were important that did happen in our past. I'm going to give you an example, and this example actually isn't even from my first year students. It's from a course I taught. I invented a course when I was working on my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. And I'm no fool. In order to get my book done, I invented a course called Lies My Teacher Told Me. It had a subtitle, Issues in Secondary School Social Studies Education. That sounds pretty impressive, doesn't it? And partly because of the title, it got oversubscribed, and it was supposed to be a seminar, but I wound up with more than 40 students, and that was okay, so I taught them. So anyway, you can go to my website, and one of the things you can do there is take a quiz. You will flunk this quiz in American history, but you will have more fun flunking it than you have had ever taking any quiz and passing it in American history, so you'll enjoy that. Well, some of the questions on this quiz were funny ones, but most of them were serious, And I just wanted to see what students would say, what they knew, and so on. I need to tell you that my students took this matter dead seriously. How can you give us a quiz on the first day of class? How much of our grade is going to be based on this? I told them 70%. And one of the questions was, the war in Vietnam was fought between blank and blank. Now, the war in Vietnam, I'll get to that in a minute, but anyway, I wanted to see whether they would put North and South Vietnam, or whether they would put, which I think is more accurate, the United States in Vietnam. But anyway, to my astonishment, 22% of them said the war in Vietnam was fought between North and South Korea. You can't make this stuff up, right? One of them even demanded half credit for getting North and South correct. I said, what if you had put North and South Dakota? Well, anyway, they pointed out, first of all, that their American history class never got anywhere near the war in Vietnam. It petered to a halt, kind of maybe after World War II, maybe getting to Korea a little bit. And that's still happening even. And secondly, they pointed out, so they hadn't gotten to it. And secondly, of course, they pointed out that they had not even been born when the war in Vietnam ended, which, of course, was also true. Now the students haven't even been born when Trump was elected. I mean, it's astounding. So still, the war in Vietnam was fought between North and South Korea. All right, so I became aware of all this, that history is mistaught all across the United States, that Mississippi was kind of an exaggerated instance of a national problem, as Mississippi was the exaggerated instance of a lot of national problems, right? And that's what led to my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. The first thing I did is I intensively read 12 U.S. history high school textbooks. I am the only American ever to attempt this feat. It was a near-death experience. It took years. I don't know why you're laughing. It took years of psychotherapy. Anyway, so I did this, and I wrote the book, and it actually became a bestseller, as you know. In fact, it is the best-selling book by a living sociologist. Okay? There are sociologists who have done better, but they are dead. So in about 2005, people were saying to me, Americans have this touching view of progress, you know, things are getting better. We think that in general. And the underlying storyline of all U.S. history high school textbooks is this. We started out great, and we've been getting better kind of ever since, kind of automatically. I mean, you people should vote, but you don't really need to do much else than that because we're getting better all the time. Well, and therefore, a lot of people thought my book had become an antique. I mean, the books are better, right? Some of your books are all the way back in 1975 and 1985. So in 2006, I wrote a second edition. I did not read 12 more books, first of all, because I couldn't bring myself to, and second of all, because of publisher consolidation, there aren't 12, so I read 6 more, and so now I've read 18. And when I was reading these new 6 ones, an interesting thing happened. There's a whole new chapter, the new chapter that treats our war in Iraq and the election of George W. Bush in Florida and things like that. And so I'm reading all 6 books in order on that subject, right? And I'm reading this book and I'm saying, wait a minute, didn't I just read this? And sure enough, I did. I got this other book, and for paragraph after paragraph, page after page, these two books are identical. Now, that was interesting. One of them is by Boorstin and Kelly. Daniel Boorstin he's deceased now, was the Librarian of Congress. Historian, won the Pulitzer Prize 2 times. His co-author, Brooks Mather Kelly, was chief archivist at Yale. Okay? And their book is identical to Pathways to the Present, written by four professors at Miami University of Ohio. The guy in charge of the most recent period was Alan Winkler, whose title is Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University. After I heard that that was his title, I decided that I had a new title, and my title is Super Duper Professor of Sociology in Washington, D.C. Okay? All right. So I called these folks up to find out how this had happened. Well, I couldn't call up Borsten because he had just died. But I called up Kelly, and Kelly said, Borsten did it. But he didn't mean Borsten copied. He meant Borsten wrote the last chapter. And I said to him, well, did you know that for page after page, and the captions of the photograph, the same photos, the same captions, everything, once in a while you'll have a word vary that's in this one, but isn't in that one. So they went through different copy editing, things like that. But otherwise, absolutely identical. I said, did you know that for page after page, it's identical to this other book by Alan Winkler et al.? And he said, and I quote, he said, oh, no, that's terrible. Okay? Pretty soon, he admitted, quote, Prentice Hall hired somebody to teach it, I mean, to write it. I forget the man's name. So the real authors, we don't even know who they are. The authors whose names are on the books, are those names are rented. And this is generally true. It's not just these two books. So I forget the man's name. That's the quality control. It's not as if the authors have any idea of who wrote, what their qualifications are. After I've given this talk sometimes, I actually had one woman come up one time and said, yeah, this is exactly what happened. She said, I wrote chapter on the Civil War. And I said, what, for somebody else, for a different textbook, and I said, what are your qualifications for that? And she said, I have a BA in English. Okay. All right. So then I called up the other, can I say author? You understand if I say author, I mean not author? Okay. So I called up the other author, Winkler. And Alan Winkler had actually, he knows my book, he had reviewed it very positively for The Guardian of England, and so we had a nice conversation. And then I asked him about his chapter, and he said, he implied he wrote it, and I said, well, did you know that for page after page it is identical to this other book by Borsten and Kelly? And he said, and I quote, oh no, that's terrible. He did. And then he said, I haven't even read that book, still kind of implying that he wrote it. Pretty soon he admits he didn't write it. I say to him, well, aside from the fact you didn't write it, what do you think about it as a work of history? And he said, and I quote, just a minute, let me get it down from the shelf. Meaning, how the hell would I know? I don't read it either. All right? So now, you know, I submit, if any of you are college students still, and you pay $9.95 for your term paper, which is stupid, don't do it, at least you have the brains to read the damn thing before you hand it in. I mean, these folks could have Osama bin Laden being a Jewish rabbi. They have no idea what they wrote, right? All right, so that's what we're dealing with. This is why I wrote Lies My Teacher Told Me, okay? Well, after Americans get done with high school history, which on the whole, not every class, on the whole they hate. Every single survey that's ever been done, when you ask students, what's your favorite subject? History always comes in last, every national survey. I'm not saying that's true in every district or every high school. It's not, but nationally that's true. Okay. For good reason, it's taught with no relevance to the present. Well, I sometimes hold up my book and I say, I could have subtitled this book, Revenge Against Coach DeMolin. Because he was my history teacher, and he was, of course, the basketball coach. Now, you can't have the basketball coaches just teaching PE, physical education. There aren't enough courses to go around for all the coaches. In football alone, you've got the coach, you've got the assistant coach, you've got the junior varsity coach, and you've got the freshman coach. I come from basketball country, Central Illinois. You've got the same thing going on in basketball. Then we haven't even gotten into so-called minor sports like soccer and track and volleyball and everything else. There's just not enough courses going around. Now, you cannot imagine having Coach DeMolin teaching English. The students would all come out illiterate. Even Coach DeMolin can't imagine teaching math. So you have Coach DeMolin teaching something that's not relevant. That's how it's not important. So at the same moment that we assigned Coach DeMolin to teach history, we demoralize the rest of the history department that cares about history. All right? So it's just a disaster, typically. Now, I have to say, this is getting better. This isn't a big California problem. It is a big Texas problem. It's a big Midwestern problem, and it's a big Southern problem. Even to this day, teachers who want to teach history are told in grad school, in ed school, well, you better learn how to coach something. Terrible, you know? Because history is important. In fact, I would argue that U.S. history is absolutely crucial for your job as an American. Your job as an American is to bring into being the America of the future, isn't it?
Yes.
And in order to do that, you have to be able to think causally. If we want America, for example, to become less racist, then we might look at periods in American history when we became less racist, because there were some. If we want America to become more racist, then we can look at some other periods and think and apply that. History has some causality ideas that relate to the present, that relate to our job as an American. But the textbooks deliberately leave out the present and don't bring in it, because that would be controversial. And that's the last thing they want to be. Okay? Well, after you hated history in high school, what are you going to do? I'll tell you what my dad did. He made our car on family vacations stop at every damn historical marker that we went past. Did any of you have dads like mine? Some of you. And so I wrote a follow-up book, Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong, because it turns out a whole bunch of them are terrible. All right? Just plain terrible. Some of them are funny terrible. And it's the funny terrible ones I'm going to tell you about tonight, because you're supposed to have fun. This is a dinner, right? Okay? So let me tell you a couple of the funny ones. Did you know, for instance, that the airplane was not invented by the Wright brothers and first flown at Kitty Hawk in 1903? And we know this because of an official Texas historical marker. Now, I got to tell you, Texas has almost as many historical markers as the rest of the country put together. Okay? And I made that point to the person in charge of historical markers in the Capitol in Austin. And her reply was, well, yes. Okay? They're putting in between 300 and 400 a year in Texas. There are whole states. I mean, like the state of Washington has 52 historical markers, okay? Texas is at 15,000 at this point, okay? Some of them are really cool. Like, for instance, they have one in Galveston, Texas that says, it's out in the street, and it says, this building used to be a hardware store. And as far as I can tell, it's correct. But anyway, they have a historical marker in Pittsburgh, Texas. And it tells about the Reverend Burrell, who was a Baptist minister, and he invented the airplane in 1902, a whole year before the Wright brothers. He got his plans from the book of Ezekiel in the Bible, which says something about a roaring of winds and a rushing of wings, or maybe it's the other way around. I don't see that as a plan for an airplane, but he did. And he invented an airplane, and I'm now going to describe it for you, but I have to go away from the microphone. So I'm going to talk really loud. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, so his airplane had a vertically mounted paddle wheel. A paddle wheel works really well on a river because there's a difference between water and not water. Okay? But in an airplane, it goes down and it generates a whole bunch of lift. And then it goes this way and it generates some forward motion. But then, oops, it goes up. And it goes backward, you know? So I am not convinced that this airplane ever got off the ground, but it must have, because the state of Texas tells us that it did. Okay? Actually, I found a primary source on this matter. The bishop himself said later on, I am convinced that the Lord never intended this airplane to fly. Okay? So I don't think it did. Now, did you know that the automobile was not invented by the Benz people, nor was it invented by these French people, It was invented by this guy in Racine, Wisconsin. It must be true because there's an official State of Wisconsin historical marker in Racine for the invention of the automobile. There are also three different historical markers in the state of Indiana for the invention of three different automobiles, each of which was the first in the world, not just in Indiana. So that's four already that are the first in the world, not counting Mercedes-Benz and the people in France. It's a great country, you know. We can invent the automobile first four times. No other country can do that, if you think about it. Okay. So I had a good time writing that book. Actually, parts of that book are just as serious and just as tragic as with the story I started with. It's in a total revision because of all the things that have been happening to Confederate monuments and other monuments this last 2 years. And I am going to brag. I haven't talked about this anywhere before, but that book in 1999, when it first came out, called for the toppling of 20 different monuments across the United States. People thought this was outlandish. This is an outrage. You can't write and call for stuff like that, you know? And they're being toppled now. And more power to them.
You're listening to James Lowen on History Textbooks, Facts or Fiction. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
So, I have some more monument stories, but they are sad ones, and I'm not going to inflict them upon you. I'm going to close instead with a statement in praise of the station, because I think you can never, let me see if I put this right in terms of, this is about a triple negative statement. You can never underestimate the amount of stupidity in the American people. Or maybe it's, you can never overestimate. See how many negatives there are? Here's what I'm trying to say. American people need a lot of help. And stations like this give it to them. And I'm going to give you a few examples of questions commonly asked at historic sites and other National Park Service sites that will show you how desperate the situation really is, okay? I come from D.C. these days, and in D.C., you know, we have this thing called the Washington Monument that is circled by a big, majestic circle of American flags. And the Park Service repeatedly gets asked, how do you get all the flags to point in the same direction? Okay. It gets better. Right? And then the Smithsonian institutions right along there, people come in and say, I understand there's a really good mall around here. Now, up and down the East Coast, there are Civil War battles, right? From Gettysburg all the way down to Louisiana. And repeatedly, we get this statement. Isn't it amazing how they fought all these battles in parks? And I swear to God, one woman, I shouldn't give away her gender, but she is a congressman's wife. We want to hope it's a Republican congressman, but I'm not sure. Asked last year at Gettysburg, how could they fight a battle here with all these statues? Again, you can't make this stuff up, right? Now, here's a little more subtle one, and it happens all the time. Does the wife of the unknown soldier get to be buried with him? Okay? Think about it. This group laughed first. Some of these people still haven't laughed. You may have to go talk with them afterward. Okay? Okay. All right. Continuing. Stop laughing. I'm going to tell you another one. Continuing a little further west, you get to Mammoth Cave. How much of the cave is underground? And further west still, you get to Canyon du Chelly in New Mexico. Are there any undiscovered ruins in the park? It kind of of a reasonable question if you think about it, but if you then think about it, it's not a reasonable question, okay? Let's see what other ones I want to tell you. Just a couple more. We're working our way further west, okay? So at Yellowstone, what do you do with the animals at night? And then worse than that, what do you do with the animals in the winter? Okay. And at Grand Teton, at what elevation do the deer become elk? Now, so far as I know, you are a fine radio station, but you have not addressed some of these questions. So you have work to do, right? And I'm going to close with one final one, which is a really sad one, okay? And it happens over and over again, and it takes us back to history. At Abraham Lincoln's home, quite a nice house in Springfield, did the president and first lady come back here after his term of office? So that's what we're dealing with, and that's why we're on a never-ending quest. Thank you very much for your attention. I want to say one more thing. If you want, we can have a question period. It's up to you all. That'd be fine with me. One other comment. I wrote a book called Sundown Towns, but do you all know what a sundown town is? Okay, you need to know, because there's a bunch of them around here. A sundown town is a town that for many decades was, and some of them still are, all white on purpose. And I wrote the book on this, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I wrote the book on it because the first sundown town I ever learned about, I learned about in college. I went to Carleton College in Minnesota, and particularly back then, a bunch of the students were from Minnesota, and the richest, I spent Thanksgiving vacation with a friend of mine, a new friend of mine, in Edina, Minnesota, which is the richest suburb of Minneapolis. And the slogan in Edina at that time was, not one Negro and not one Jew. And they didn't have one either, okay? I am now good friends with the first Jew ever to move into Edina, and his wife, who is now deceased, was African-American. So they took care of it right there, one family, okay? And Edina is now kind of ashamed of its past and has apologized for it and has over 1,100 African-Americans in their population of 80,000, and so they're no longer a sundown town. But that was the first sundown town I learned of. The second sundown town I learned of is one you can all go learn of, and I hereby assign you, if you have not done so already, to go home and rent, or if you were younger, pirate, the famous movie, Gentleman's Agreement, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture of 1947, starring Gregory Peck, no less. And it's about the agreement by which Darien, Connecticut, which is an Edina of New York City, kept out Jews, okay? And this movie, though it was very famous in 1947, made no difference whatsoever in Darien. And Darien is still pretty much a sundown town, vis-a-vis both Jews and blacks, although there are some Jewish families in it. I don't know if there are any black families. Okay. The third sundown town that pushed me over the edge and forced me to write the book was Anna, Illinois. Anna is down in southern Illinois. It was named for a woman named Anna in 1854. But in 1909, it threw out its black population, and somewhere after that, it became known as ANNA, Ain't No Niggers Anywhere. And I thought that was just too outrageous, and so I decided to write this book. I knew I came from Illinois. I was going to spend more time in Illinois than any other single state, although I did a lot of research in Oregon, a fair amount in California, some in Indiana, and all across the United States. Mississippi. I thought I would discover 10 sundown towns maybe in Illinois, maybe 50 across the country, and I'm now at a count of 506 sundown towns in Illinois alone. 70% of all the towns that there are in Illinois, I think 70% of all towns in Oregon. I sometimes use the term sundown neighborhood, Okay? But I don't write about that, and I'll tell you why. There are all kinds of people who do write about it. There are all kinds of people who have been writing about it, okay? There's at least 10 really good books about residential segregation in Chicago, for example. And there was no book whatsoever about sundown towns until I wrote it. None. Okay? It was mentioned, I know, because I didn't even want to write it. I did an exhaustive literature research so I wouldn't have to write it. And I found exactly 4 brief mentions of sundown towns in 4 books written between 1900 and 1960 or so, and nothing after that. 4 mentions, okay? So somebody's got to do it. So to get to be a sundown town, I have very high standards. I'm speaking a little bit ironically, but you have to have fewer than 10 black people who are residents. Now, I got to say, you got to be careful doing this research. Anna, Illinois, which I've already described, if you look up Anna in 1970 or 1990 or whatever, it has about 80 black folks, of whom 80 are living in the Illinois State Mental Hospital. Okay? We have Vandalia, Illinois, the first capital of Illinois, sundown town until at least 1995. But if you look at it in 1990, say, it has about 1,500 black folks, of whom about 1,500 are male between the age of 18 and 70. That's a prison, all right? So I don't mean to say they don't count, but they don't count as residents of the city. By the way, that's one other point I want to make. I don't know about California on this regard, but several states, most amazingly Illinois, but New York also, and maybe some others, put prisons in sundown towns. This is the worst idea in the history of the world for a whole bunch of reasons. I'll just mention one, which is, every prisoner knows that every person he comes into contact with, whether a chaplain or a guard or a cook or a Boy Scout getting a merit badge, they all have chosen to live in a sundown town. This does not build trust. And furthermore, every white person in the town who hears personally about any black person is hearing about a criminal. All right? This does not build good race relations in either directions. It's just totally stupid. And there's about 8 other things wrong with it, too. It isn't done on purpose to be stupid, but it works out that way. All right, question time.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about if you see similar problems in the college textbook market, because it's one of the reasons I don't use college textbooks very much, because I find the college textbooks, while they might be a little more sophisticated in some language, right, they still have the problem with women and people of color appearing as a box.
Yeah. Well, let me say this. I do whole workshops for teachers, mainly for K-12 teachers, on how to teach history and get students involved. The reason I thought about that is because you're already saying some of the things I say. That is to say, if you want, I assert we are not teaching the forest for the trees. We're not. We're teaching twigs, right? Little twigs like, you know, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1400 and, you know, 93 is the right answer in a way. Some of you said that, because in 1493 he actually did something new. You know, in 1492 he did nothing new. But anyway, what teachers need to do is they need to pick 30 to 50 topics and teach the hell out of them. Each one of these 30 to 50 topics needs to be something they're excited to teach, something they think nobody should graduate high school without having thought about. And then they can use the textbook, they can teach against the textbook, they can ignore the textbook, depending on what topic is. Sometimes the textbook's great on that topic, sometimes the textbook's terrible. College textbooks are somewhat better. And I know that because inadvertently, a college textbook sneaked into my sample of 12 when I first went to write lies my teacher told me. And it wasn't great. It wasn't one of the better college textbooks, but it was a college textbook. And the way I proceed is I pick a topic, let's say the war in Iraq or Columbus or whatever, and I read what all 12 of these books said. And this one kept coming out slightly better than any of the others. And one of the topics I read, I ended up not writing about it, was the Alamo. And when it came out slightly better than the others on the Alamo, even though the author of this textbook was at the University of Texas, I realized something's going on, so I called him up. And I said, you know, I've been reading your textbook. I'm comparing 12 different high school textbooks, and it always comes up slightly better, or somewhat better. How come? And he said, hold it right there. It's not a high school history textbook. It's a college textbook. Now, I had found it used in a high school in Vermont, and I hadn't really thought about it that well, and he had to know. He was right, of course. So that was an inadvertent experiment I did. So I threw it out, and I replaced it with a different book. So I can therefore state that I've done a natural experiment on this matter, and so, yes, they are somewhat better. And furthermore, I think some of the authors had something to do with some of the books in college, although just for the record, lots of college textbooks are ghostwritten too. It's a disgusting phenomenon. But yes, they're somewhat better, but they still need work like you were implying. Yes, sir. Biased, ethnocentric textbooks are a world phenomenon. It's not limited to the United States. I do think, and I'm serious in this, I do think that we win the prize for the most ethnocentric. And I'll tell you why. First of all, no other country can say with a straight face, we are the dominant military in the world. We are the dominant single economy in the world. And, get this next one, we are the dominant culture in the world. And that last statement, you might say, are we really? But, you know, it hit me upside the head several Olympics ago when I watched the Chinese female divers, who by then were just becoming the very best in the world, which they still are, and after they finished a really good dive, they would high-five each other. Now, they did not learn to do that out in Sichuan province, you know. They learned to do that from us, if you will. And it's not just Coca-Cola. There's a lot of us, our mannerisms, our stuff, that goes around the world and becomes dominant, okay? So it's easier for us to be the most ethnocentric, and I think we are. And I therefore submit to you that our textbooks don't have to reinforce this. We've got enough of it already, right? Now, I just want you to think about the titles of our textbooks, you know? Did any of you ever take chemistry in high school? Can I see a hand if you did? All right, there's you, sir, with the handsome beard, even better than my own. What was the title of your chemistry textbook in high school? Chemistry. I think that's accurate. A lot of them are called chemistry, okay? Now, if you take say, American literature in high school, which you can, it's called Reader in American Literature. If you take U.S. history, it's called Rise of the American Nation. And after we lost the Vietnam War, that one was retitled Triumph of the American Nation. Okay. The Great Republic, right? One of them is called, so help me God, Land of the Brave, and another one is called Home of the Free. Or is it the other way around? I forget. I think the other way around, but anyway, you get the picture. The Great Republic, the American pageant, etc., all right? You didn't take Triumph of the Molecules. You know? So something else is going on in American history. It's not just education, it's nationalism. And I submit to you, it is not patriotism. I take my definition of patriotism from this guy, Frederick Douglass. You've heard of him? And he says, give him a pass on his sexist language. He was really good on gender and sex and stuff. But he said, I call him a true patriot who rebukes his country for its sins and does not excuse them, all right? And I submit that's exactly patriotic. And I submit nationalism, on the other hand, we don't got no sins. What the hell are you talking about? I'm going to hit you upside the head with this 5.5-pound history textbook if you say we do. That's nationalism. I suggest to you nationalism is not patriotic, all right? Now, let me say that in terms of Africa, South Africa, as you know, went through a little political change a couple decades ago called One Person, One Vote. And they produced thereafter a remarkable book. It is called A New History for a New South Africa. And I read it. It's written by four women. I think they are all K-12 teachers in South Africa. They may be mostly white, I'm not sure. But they start off the following. They say, we used to teach the following six myths when we were under apartheid. And maybe they were appropriate for apartheid. They were certainly supportive. I would not argue they were appropriate because I'm kind of in favor of truth. But anyway. And I read these six myths and I say, yeah, you know, we teach about four of them still in the United States. Then they say, at the beginning of the book, these myths are no longer appropriate for the new South Africa. What are we going to teach? And the rest of the book is they're wrestling with that and thinking about it. It's a terrific book. Similarly, Russia, or actually the USSR, just before it dissolved, it went through this period, you guys will remember it, some of them, called Glasnost, under, what's his name? Gorbachev, thank you. And Russia, you know, gives a standardized test every spring in every subject. K-12, I think, but certainly in high school. And one year, in May, they actually canceled the test in history because they said, we've been teaching a bunch of ethnocentric BS. We can't test this stuff. We got to write new textbooks. And I thought, now, wouldn't that be cool if we canceled the SAT advanced test in PSAT, APUSH it's called, Advanced Placement U.S. History Test, saying, we've been teaching a bunch of ethnocentric BS, we got to cancel the test, that'd be cool. But they did that in Russia, and then they revamped the textbooks and came out with something better. I don't know what they're teaching now, I gotta say that. So it's an international problem, and some other countries are handling a lot better than we are. All right, one more question maybe, way back there in the red. I'll get to you two. I saw your hand. Two more questions. Go ahead.
Do you support the toppling of racist monuments like of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson?
Absolutely not, and I'm going to tell you why. I think we have to be more sophisticated than that. If you think about a Confederate monument, let's think about, how about Jefferson Davis on Monument Avenue in Richmond? You know, you should go to Richmond. There are more entries about Richmond in Lines Across America than about any other single place. That maybe is because Richmond's had more history or because they got it more wrong. All right, and so the very first monument on Monument Avenue is to Jefferson Davis. University of Texas had a monument to Jefferson Davis on its campus until last year when they toppled it, okay? Jefferson Davis is all over the place. Now, why is Jefferson Davis monumentalized? It's monumentalized because he was the president of the Confederacy, right? So we are remembering him precisely because he led a treasonous government on behalf of slavery. And what I did this afternoon and twice yesterday was I showed with primary sources that the Confederacy seceded for slavery, not for states' rights. Quite the opposite, they were seceding against states' rights, okay? So there is absolutely no excuse to worship Jefferson Davis with monuments extolling his virtues, since we are doing so precisely because he stood for white supremacy. Now, it is true that Abraham Lincoln was on occasion a white supremacist, overtly so, for example, in one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Do we have statues of him because he was a white supremacist? I submit to you, we do not. We have statues to him because he was also, at times, anti-racist and anti-slavery. And that's why we have statues of him. Similarly, and not so goodly, George Washington, we do not put statues up for him because he owned slaves. We put up statues because he was the general who held the army together through the war, and then because he was the first president and did a halfway decent job in some ways, and because he also set a remarkable precedent, followed, of course, by Nelson Mandela and some other people, of resigning after two terms, a precedent that would be good if the guy in Zimbabwe had followed, and so on. So we have to think about, why are we memorializing these people? And if we say, well, we can't put up a statue or can't name a building for anybody who ever owned slaves, that won't do. We can always de-heroify these people. The very first chapter in Lies My Teacher Told Me is a chapter about the malady I call heroification, in which we try to teach our heroes without feet of clay, without even a wart, without even a blemish. I'm not in favor of that, but I'm also not in favor of some simple-minded rule that says, if he did anything bad, then we're not putting up a statue to him, because ain't nobody who didn't do something bad. Okay, thanks a lot for all your questions.
You were just listening to James Lowen on History Textbooks, Facts or Fiction. He spoke in Fresno, California in 2018. James Lowen is the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, winner of the American Book Award. He was a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont. He died in August 2021. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Tariq Ali, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, Kianga Yamata Taylor, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Richard Withers and KFCF. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Sam Cooke. What a Wonderful World.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.